We're off again to Paris to get Marie Antoinette's view of the city in 15 minutes. But now on 4 Extra, first broadcast in 1999, there's a warm welcome awaiting Beowulf as he arrives home, and he's got a few yarns to tell after ridding the Danes of Grendel and his mother. Seamus Heaney reads part 7 of his own translation of the epic Old English poem.
Heroic Beowulf and his band of men crossed the wide strand, striding along the sandy foreshore. The sun shone. The world's candle warmed them from the south as they hastened to where, as they had heard, the young king, Ongentheow's killer and his people's protector, was dispensing rings inside his bone. Beowulf's return was reported to Higelac as soon as possible. News that the captain was now in the enclosure, his battle brother back from the fray, alive and well, walking to the hall. Room was quickly made on the king's orders, and the troops filed across the cleared floor. After Higelac had offered greetings to his loyal thane in lofty speech, he and his kinsman, that hale survivor, sat face to face. Haereth's daughter moved about with the mead jug in her hand, taking care of the company, filling the cups that warriors held out. Then Higelac began to put courteous questions to his old comrade in the high hall. He hankered to know every tale the sea geats had to tell. "How did you fare on your foreign voyage, dear Beowulf, when you abruptly decided to sail away across the salt water and fight at Heorot? Did you help Hrothgar much in the end? Could you ease the prince of his well-known troubles? Your undertaking cast my spirits down. I dreaded the outcome of your expedition and pleaded with you long and hard to leave the killer be. Let the South Danes settle their own blood feud with Grendel. So God be thanked, I am granted this sight of you, safe and sound." Beowulf, son of Eadsthiel, spoke. "What happened, Lord Higelac, is hardly a secret any more among men in this world. Myself and Grendel coming to grips on the very spot where he had visited destruction on the victory shieldings and violated life and limb. Losses I avenged, so no earthly offspring of Grendel's need ever boast of that bout before dawn, no matter how long the last of his evil family survives. When I first landed, I proceeded to the ring hall and saluted Hrothgar. Once he discovered why I had come, the son of Halfdane sent me immediately to sit with his own sons on the bench. It was a happy gathering. In my whole life, I have never seen mead enjoyed more in any hall on earth. Sometimes the queen herself appeared, peace pledge between nations, to hearten the young ones and hand out a torque to a warrior, then take her place. Sometimes Hrothgar's daughter distributed ale to older ranks in order on the benches. I heard the company call her Freya Waru as she made her rounds, presenting men with the gem-studded bowl, young bride-to-be to the gracious Ingeld in her gold-trimmed attire. The friend of the Shieldings favours her betrothal. The guardian of the kingdom sees good in it and hopes this woman will heal old wounds and grievous feuds. But generally the spear is prompt to retaliate when a prince is killed, no matter how admirable the bride may be. Think how the Heathobards will be bound to feel, their lord Ingeld and his loyal thanes, when he walks in with that woman to the feast. Danes are at the table, being entertained, honoured guests in glittering regalia, burnished ringmail that was their host's birthright, looted when the Heathobards could no longer wield their weapons in the shield clash, when they went down with their beloved comrades and forfeited their lives. Then an old spearman will speak while they are drinking, having glimpsed some heirloom that brings alive memories of the massacre. His mood will darken, and heart-stricken, in the stress of emotion, he will begin to test a young man's temper and stir up trouble, starting like this. Now, my friend, don't you recognize your father's sword, his favorite weapon, the one he wore when he went out in his war mask to face the Danes on that final day? After Weathergeld died and his men were doomed, the Shieldings quickly claimed the field. And now, here's a son of one or other of those same killers coming through our hall, overbearing us, mouthing boasts, and rigged in armour that by right is yours. And so he keeps on, recalling and accusing, working things up with bitter words, until one of the lady's retainers lies spattered in blood, split open on his father's account. The killer knows the lie of the land and escapes with his life. Then, on both sides, the oath-bound lords will break the peace. A passionate hate will build up in Ingeld, and love for his bride will falter in him as the feud rankles. I therefore suspect the good faith of the Heathobards, the truth of their friendship, and the trustworthiness of their alliance with the Danes. But now, my lord, I shall carry on with my account of Grendel, the whole story of everything that happened in the hand-to-hand fight. After Heaven's Gem had gone mildly to earth, that maddened spirit, the terror of those twilights, came to attack us where we stood guard, still safe inside the hall. Their deadly violence came down on Hanscio, and he fell as fate ordained, the first to perish, rigged out for the combat. A comrade from our ranks had come to grief in Grendel's maw. He ate up the entire body. There was blood on his teeth. He was bloated and dangerous, all roused up, yet still unready to leave the hall empty-handed. Renowned for his might, he matched himself against me, wildly reaching. He had this roomy pouch, a strange accoutrement, intricately strung and hung at the ready, a rare patchwork of devilishly fitted dragon skins. I had done him no wrong, yet the raging demon wanted to cram me and many another into this bag. But it was not to be, once I got to my feet in a blind fury. It would take too long to tell how I repaid the terror of the land for every life he took, and so won credit for you, my king, and for all your people. And although he got away to enjoy life's sweetness for a while longer, his right hand stayed behind him in Heorot, evidence of his miserable overthrow as he dived into murk on the mere bottom. I got lavish rewards from the Lord of the Danes for my part in the battle, beaten gold and much else, once morning came and we took our places at the banquet table. There was singing and excitement. An old reciter, a carrier of stories, recalled the early days. At times some hero made the timbered harp tremble with sweetness, or related true and tragic happenings. At times the king gave the proper turn to some fantastic tale, or a battle-scarred veteran, bowed with age, would begin to remember the martial deeds of his youth and prime, and be overcome as the past welled up in his wintry heart. We were happy there the whole day long, and enjoyed our time, until another night descended upon us. Then, with sudden dispatch, the vehement mother avenged her son and wreaked destruction. Death had robbed her. Geats had slain Grendel. So his ghastly dam struck back and with barefaced defiance laid a man low. Thus life departed from the sage Ashuri, an elder wise in council. But afterwards, on the morning following, the Danes could not burn the dead body, nor lay the remains of the man they loved on his funeral pyre. She had fled with the corpse and taken refuge beneath torrents on the mountain. It was a hard blow for Hrothgar to bear, harder than any he had undergone before. And so the heart-sore king beseeched me in your royal name to take my chances underwater, to win glory and prove my worth. He promised me rewards. Hence, as is well known, I went to my encounter with the terror-monger at the bottom of the tarn. For a while it was hand to hand between us. Then blood went curling along the currents, and I beheaded Grendel's mother in the hall with a mighty sword. I barely managed to escape with my life. My time had not yet come. But Halfdane's heir, the shelter of those earls, again endowed me with a multitude of gifts. Thus the king acted with due custom. I was paid in recompense completely, given full measure and the freedom to choose from Hrothgar's treasures by Hrothgar himself. These, King Higelac, I am happy to present to you as gifts. It is still upon your grace that all favour depends. I have few kinsmen who are close, my king, except for your kind self. Then he ordered the boar-framed standard to be brought, the battle-topping helmet, the mail shirt, grey as hoar-frost, and the precious war-sword. I heard four horses were handed over next. Beowulf bestowed four bay steeds to go with the armour, swift gallopers, all alike. So ought a kinsman act, instead of plotting and planning in secret to bring people to grief, or conspiring to arrange the death of comrades. The warrior king was uncle to Beowulf, and honoured by his nephew. Each was concerned for the other's good. I heard he presented Hygd with a gorget, the priceless torque that the prince's daughter, Wealhtheow, had given him, and three horses, supple creatures, brilliantly saddled. The bright necklace would be luminous on Hygd's breast. Thus Beowulf bore himself with valour. He was formidable in battle, yet behaved with honour and took no advantage, never cut down a comrade who was drunk, kept his temper, and warrior that he was, watched and controlled his God-sent strength and his outstanding natural powers. He had been poorly regarded for a long time, was taken by the Geats for less than he was worth, and their lord too had never much esteemed him in the mead hall. They firmly believed that he lacked force, that the prince was a weakling. But presently, every affront to his deserving was reversed. The battle-famed king, bulwark of his earls, ordered a gold-chased heirloom of Hrethel's to be brought in. It was the best example of a gem-studded sword in the Geat treasury. This he laid on Beowulf's lap, and rewarded him with land as well, 7,000 hides, and a hall and a throne. Both owned land by birth in that country, ancestral grounds, but the greater right and sway were inherited by the higher born. A lot was to happen in later days in the fury of battle. Higelac fell, and the shelter of Heardred's shield proved useless against the fierce aggression of the Scylfings. Ruthless swordsmen, seasoned campaigners, they came against him and his conquering nation and with cruel force cut him down, so that afterwards the wide kingdom reverted to Beowulf. He ruled it well for 50 winters, grew old and wise as warden of the land.
Tomorrow, a much older and wiser Beowulf faces a new and dangerous challenge. Seamus Heaney was reading part 7 of his own translation of Beowulf. The producer was Susan Roberts. T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland is arguably one of the most important and influential poems of the 20th century. First published in 1922, it was quickly recognised as a landmark in modernist poetry. It's now been brought to life for radio with a reading by Eileen Atkins and Jeremy Irons.
What are the roots that clutch? What branches grow out of this stony rubbish? Son of man, you cannot say or guess, for you know only a heap of broken images, where the sun beats and the dead tree gives no shelter, the cricket no relief, and the dry stone no sound of water, only there is shadow under this red rock. Come in under the shadow of this red rock, and I will show you something different from either your shadow at morning striding behind you or your shadow at evening rising to meet you. I will show you fear in a handful of dust.
T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, read by Jeremy Irons and Eileen Atkins, is here on BBC Radio 4 Extra tomorrow morning at 11:15 and again in the evening at 9:15.
You're listening to BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now, more from this week's history of the French capital, as seen through the eyes of some of its famous citizens and visitors. This time we get lost and confused with a member of the royal family, in Parisians by Graham Robb.
Marie-Antoinette had organised the journey herself, as far as Chalon. After the exodus from Versailles, when guardsmen's heads were wigged and powdered and held aloft on pikes, it had been a consoling hobby. Monsieur de Fersen had ordered a long-distance coach which was to wait outside the city at the Barrière Saint-Martin. Meanwhile, General de Bouillé was positioning loyal troops along the route to the eastern frontier. Nothing had been left to chance. The coach contained a well-stocked larder, a cooker, and a false floor that could be turned into a dining table. To avoid suspicion, they were to leave in four separate groups. The governess, Madame de Tourzelle, would take the Dauphin and his sister to the nearby Rue de l'Echelle, where Monsieur de Fersen would be waiting outside a busy hotel, disguised as a cab driver. Three quarters of an hour later, they would be joined by the King's sister, Madame Elisabeth. And when the ceremony of the coucher de roi was over and the King had been put to bed, they would be joined by the King himself, dressed as a valet de chambre. The Queen would leave the palace last of all, with one of the trusted bodyguards, Monsieur de Maldon. The route from her apartments to the corner of the Rue de l'Echelle was short enough to present no difficulties. The total distance was less than 500 yards. Few people believed the rumours spread by journalists that the royal family was intending to escape. But Monsieur de Lafayette, head of the Garde Nationale, had doubled his men, just in case, and ordered the palace to be lit as though for a grand occasion. The Queen was to wear a broad-brimmed hat to hide her face. A needless precaution, she thought.